From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to 2 hours of sports analytics here on SiriusXM, coming to you from the Business Radio studios in Huntsman Hall, Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, West Philadelphia. That's right, we're in studio today. We are here with Eric Bradlow, with Shane Jensen. Our collaborator, Audie Weiner, is away doing Audie things. This is Cade Massey. Audie will be back in at some point, of course. We're going to be here for the next 2 hours talking sports and sports analytics. We do it every week, have been doing it every week for 9 years now. We're just past the anniversary of our show, 2014, March 2014. 9 years, now 9 years plus. Have been enjoying it. Lots more to talk about. Don't know when we're going to slow down. We've got a fun show today. We've got a couple of interviews in Q2 and Q3. We've slipped back into our original model of interviews in Q2 and Q3. Q2, Mike Kelly, NHL Network and analytics guy we've had on the show before, talking NHL and hockey analytics. Eric and Shane do that interview. And in Q3, Thomas Dimitroff, the longtime Atlanta Falcons general manager. We get to visit with him about general manager things in the world of football in Q3. We had that interview, I think all four of us were on that one recently. Q1, Q4, open lines, open topics. Curious what these guys have in mind. I think I know what it's likely to be. Q1, Shane is just chomping at the bit. Shane Jensen.
Oh my goodness, the World Baseball Classic. I have never been so hyped going into a baseball season. Well, I've never been so hyped going into a baseball season where my favorite team is so mediocre. Then this is a way of getting hyped about baseball in general, I guess, is what I'm struggling to say. Because we've had so many, it's been like a playoff atmosphere during spring training. It's been incredible. The play, amazing individual performances. Like, the players are obviously very, very excited and hyped to kind of be there. And some really kind of unique things that we haven't really kind of seen before. Some insight into the future of baseball.
Real quickly, setting the scene, we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, as we usually do. The show will go up on Wednesday morning, be replayed a few times. But tonight is the final. Tonight's the final. U.S. made it into the final. Japan made it into the final. Both teams in dramatic late-inning fashion. So that's where we are. One more piece of context. You're talking about it with such excitement. Given that we've been doing this for 9 years, there have been two or three of these things before in our lifetime, and in our show's lifetime. I don't remember being this amped up about it. Is it the case that more players are involved? Is it the case that it has a different stage in some way? What's different this time around?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, more players are involved. I mean, I think the kind of various, the sport has grown in several countries. I mean, other countries besides America have become more dominant over the last decade or so. I mean, Japan won the first couple of these things. Japan's been good at this for a while. But, having nations like the Dominican Republic and Venezuela and Puerto Rico kind of we play separately as well. All these countries kind of legitimately, five or six teams could kind of win it all, which given kind of that, it's not, we don't think about it necessarily as a fully global sport. It's pretty impressive that there's, essentially five or six amazing teams that could win it in any year. And also within each team, I think more Major League Baseball players are playing because they've put in spring training. And I think there's just a greater kind of like excitement and acceptance of that happening.
I think two things come to my mind about it. First, let's remember, they've got the timing perfectly. I mean, let's say you're an NFL fan. Well, there's not really anything going on in the NFL right now.
Yeah.
Let's say you're an NBA fan. There's stuff going on, but it's not the end of the season yet. It's not the playoffs. There's still a month to go. It's not that. You're an NHL fan. Well, the NHL's still going on, so that's the regular season there. I mean, in some sense, let's say you're a golf fan, which I am. Well, it's not the Masters yet. It's not the season yet. It's in between tennis majors. So, I mean, if you look at all the large sports, they've timed this perfectly. Obviously, the NCAA tournament's going on, which has interfered. That's a big one. That's a big one. But, I'll give them credit. At least the finals tonight is not opposite any NCAA tournament action. So I think, number one, they've timed it well.
Can I jump on that real
please.
Quick? I saw The Athletic does a morning email, and in that email, they suggested, how about moving it to the All-Star break? And they argued that that was an even deader moment on the athletic calendar.
I mean,
and who really cares about the All-Star game anyway?
There's not enough time. You'd have to make it like a 3-week break.
A multi-week break.
You'd have to make it a multi-week break. And the baseball season's already going on from April until now. There's games in Mr. November.
Yeah.
You just couldn't do
it. I would want them to drop games.
Yeah, no, because it's really about, again, getting buy-in from the Major League Baseball teams that are willing to kind of have their players do this. And I mean, you can certainly argue no matter when in the year it goes, like to the extent that it drums up excitement, you know, in the sport, that's a good thing. But you're also trying to kind of like, you know, something like this where, you know, they have to do spring training and kind of cycle up anyway. So why not have, you know, we're kind of in the part of the year for baseball, necessary baseball exhibition anyway.
Yes.
Why not have it be this international competition as opposed to spring training
games?
Well, that
was one of the things I was wondering. You know, historically, when we look at the data years over years, they always say pitchers are ahead of hitters. Hitters typically start out the season slower. In other words, it takes hitters longer to adjust. I'll be very interested to look at these major league hitters. Do they start off the season better than ones that did spring training? It's obviously a very simple analysis.
So many just fun confounding variables to kind of put in there. We've got a biggest confounding error is it's only the best hitters that are participating, like, you know, coming up with the right comparison.
Well, here's what I'll do. No. So here's, I thought about that this morning. So two statistical analyses I can do is, one is I can compare those hitters to their historical averages. And the good news is, because they're the best hitters, they've all been playing for enough years that there will be enough, let's call it early at-bats. Then I can, of course, compare them to the rest of the league. And so, and again, what I'm looking for is, you know, if you'd like in a statistical term, I'm looking for a difference. Mm-hmm. It's how well are they doing versus their baseline, and how well are they doing versus the other player's baseline. So I could literally take a difference. I could take their difference to their baseline. I could take the other player's difference to their baseline.
You think you'll have enough power for that, given the number of players?
I think there's probably is enough at-bats.
Because we have multiple teams. Because you have Major League Baseball players playing for all these countries, essentially.
Well, I'll get to that point in a second. But I agree with you. I do think there's enough statistical power. But, of course, the issue is always, what's the effect size? I mean, if you tell me that it's instead of hitting 270 the first month of the season, they're hitting 275, no. If you're telling me it's a 15 to 20 point difference, I didn't do the math. I apologize. I should have. I could compute how many at-bats would you need in each set to actually identify a statistical effect of a given size.
The basic idea is that the smaller the effect size, the larger the sample you need to demonstrate
Correct.
That reliably.
Exactly.
So what's your intuition, Shane? You're the one who suggested that you started this whole thing about batting average. You think there's going to be that much of a difference?
No. And I'm not even sure which way I'll go, because the additional confounder that I've been wanting to kind of mention is the one thing they haven't been doing is getting used to the pitch clock. Well, another kind of interesting analysis would be, you know, to the extent that they're making, you know, they're going to start losing balls for, like, you know, are the hitters are our best hitters of the game going to have all these kind of, you know, pitch violations to start season, because they haven't been actually, like, getting used to the pitch clock.
There's about a week left, right? There's a week until the regular season starts, right?
Doesn't are we that close?
I think it starts the first week of April. Yeah. It has to be like the end of next week.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're only going to have a week under, let's call it, I assume they're going to go back to their teams almost immediately.
Yeah.
Whether they're going to play tomorrow, I can't speak to that. Probably not.
And they did have, I think, a few, like, maybe a week of, like, spring training prior to, like, you know, they did have some experience with the pitch clock before they went to the World Baseball Classic. But I still do think that's something I'm interested to see, too. Like, are some of these, like, the best hitters of the game and, you know, some of the best pitchers of the game not going to be as used in practice to kind of some of the new rules?
So I have to admit, the first question, statistical question related to the World Baseball Classic I asked myself is, I don't remember the pitcher's name, but there's a pitcher for Japan that has thrown like 30 fastballs and 29 of them have been over 100 miles an hour.
Is it Sasaki?
Sasaki, yeah.
21 years old.
Okay, so here's
throws 102.
So here's my question. It's my question. Is he already signed with a major league? So
no.
That's my question. How is it possible in today's world of analytics, in today's world of international scouting, in today's world of artificial intelligence and motion tracking and arm angle, that there would be any player that's unidentified? Maybe he was identified and no one just signed him yet. But, I mean, how does this guy not have a $300 million contract from the Yankees, Red Sox, or Phillies already?
Well, because the nature of the kind of our association with the Japan. He's been pitching in the Japan major leagues. And just for the record, you American teams aren't allowed to just grab a Japanese player whenever they
see
fit. They
aren't allowed in what sense?
They aren't allowed because these players are already under – they're drafted and already under contract into the Japanese league. So, I mean, we don't have to get the details of it, but basically – if they were to try and sign, you know, the way the arrangement works is basically until he's about 25 or so, he's probably not going to be given the option, essentially, to sign with an American team. And any efforts to do that prior to him turning 25 would involve, like, a huge posting fee. It would be much more expensive.
But hold on. That's just the world of soccer, right? That's exactly what happens in soccer, the transfer fees.
Yeah, it's a transfer fee.
It's just, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's also sort of for Japanese players. It's basically, it's kind of like the Japanese league gets their first contract.
Okay, but fine. But why wouldn't a Japanese team be happy to sell their player in the same way that La Liga teams sell to the Premier League all the time?
Oh, yeah, no, you could. You could. And again, if you wanted to basically sign this guy before he turns 25, I mean, I think that would involve like a huge... I mean,
wasn't there a Red Sox team?
Daisuke Matsuzaka was signed.
No, no, no. I thought there was someone more recent for the Red Sox, that the Red Sox paid like $100 million to buy him out of his Japanese contract. They gave him a $200 million...
Might have been Yoshida, the one we just signed. I'm not sure.
That could very well be.
The rules have also changed over time. But yeah, basically, it's you have to pay a huge premium for that. And you may want to actually... you know, wait and see if this realizes until understanding the uncertainty around 21-year-old Phenoms is probably very high.
Sure.
Why not get them? You know, I mean, this is exciting because you can still get them as 25 to 30 years.
They're not exactly paragons of patience and, you know, risk aversion when it comes to young pitching arms, right? They're forever throwing big money at these prospects. At least historically they have been.
Have they? A 21-year-old? No, I mean, because they
used to burn the first pick in the draft on 18-year-old arms
sure,
all the time.
And then
now,
waited,
maybe they learned.
And even those developed for 3 or 4 years in the minor leagues before they hit the major leagues and got the big contract, right?
Sure.
And now the MPV is basically taking the place of the minor leagues.
I'm not saying they should do this for sure,
right.
But it's a question they should ask. There is some number that you'd be willing to pay to take this young prospect, right?
Yes, no, and I just, the system as currently designed is meant to disincentivize speculation on 21-year-olds, so they are a rather relatively unique thing. But I will say that option does exist. I mean, and in fact, you know, Ohtani almost forego this forwent this whole system. He, you know, basically when he was first starting out very young, he was deciding, do I actually allow myself drafted to the Nippon Leagues or do I go directly to America?
Oh, yeah, right.
And one of the ways they convinced him to stay in Japan is a team said, we'll let you both pitch and hit. Whereas, you know, if he went to an American team without that demonstrated performance in both, he probably would have just been siloed into one or the other.
Oh,
we would never seen Ohtani as he exists
I think you've got some visceral Japan defense here. And I'm remembering what a Japanese connoisseur you have been in your lifetime. I'm feeling a little bit of like standing up for the country system here.
Well, no, I don't think necessarily, other than the fact that, you know, I mean, I think it's more kind of recognizing that, especially for Japanese-raised players, the Japanese league is probably equally attractive to them, unless they really are this next level kind of Ichiro, Shohei Ohtani kind of player. And, you know, that there is kind of that, you know, it's not so, you know, we can't really kind of, you know, they're both directed by the system and their own. You can't really think about them as 21-year-old free agents.
Got it.
Just like you can't, you know, like.
Good.
So,
can I ask one more Japan-related question? Do we know anything about the level of followership in Japanese baseball now compared to American baseball? American baseball has suffered, and this is partly why they're making these rules changes. Do we have, okay, it's a fraction of the total population maybe? Do we have a sense of how rabid the Japanese baseball
following?
I'm going
following? With much higher than
much
way
higher.
Higher. I heard that 65 million people, I think, watched the game yesterday in Japan. Considering what time it was, too, for them, it's
Good lord. Okay.
Yeah. Japan baseball in Japan is probably. I don't know if there's an American sport as big in America as baseball.
So it exceeds American football in America. Probably.
That's
from
a tougher
ratings
analogy.
Basis.
Yeah, probably. Okay.
So I was thinking of the following question to try to minimize uncertainty with this 21-year-old player. Tell me what's wrong with the following statistical analysis, which would now allow us to evaluate the players, okay? Let's say we break the batter's box, just for simplicity, into a 10 by 10 grid. So I've got 100 squares, okay? I know
the batter's box or the strike zone?
The strike zone. Sorry, the strike's not the batter. Sorry, the strike zone. I break the strike zone into 10 by 10 square. Okay? I know Sasaki is the name of the pitcher.
It's not square, though, is it? Do you really want 10 by 10? Or do you want, I mean, I don't mean to be picky, but I'm kind of curious what you mean.
I'll make them into rectangles if you're happy, because it's not the same width as it is height. Okay. Or I'll get some really round person. Either way, I'm going to create a 10 by 10 grid. I'll create whatever grid you want, okay? Now, I know where he
Warden Moneyball, where we sweat every technical detail.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just making sure I'm on the same page. Now,
we do it to each other. I mean, we do it all.
And by the way, I don't even have to discretize it if you want, but just for simplicity, I'm going to discretize the strike zone. I know where this pitcher can throw, and I know where this pitcher can throw each pitch in each part of the strike zone, because I have TrackMan data on him. He's thrown 10,000 pitches in the last 3 years. I know every pitch, everything. I know what the batting average of major league players is thrown in this part of the strike zone or out of the strike zone. So now, why can't I compute the counterfactual of how this player, and you say, well, you need wisdom. I'll literally tell him that, remember the catcher now has a device and a thing. I'll literally call the pitches for him based on some optimal sequence. So now I've got someone calling pitches for him. I know where he can put the ball at each part of the strike zone with each pitch. I'll call the pitches for them. So I'll optimize or minimize the batting average against him. I'll figure out how much money that's worth, and I'll do it. Tell me what's wrong with that line of thinking.
What's wrong with it is that there's more involved with the difficulty of hitting a pitch than where it appears when it hits the strike zone.
And you're talking about this like for any one person mechanically that's very stationary or something like that, that you wouldn't want to – like that's going to evolve over time as hitters get used to him, as he gets more experience, et cetera.
Okay.
And so, also, I mean, like it's just sort of like it's – you know, to transfer between leagues, those kind of, even those sort of details, I think it's kind of, it's difficult. I mean, I think that is an incredibly interesting analytical challenge.
I'm not taking his pitches in the Japan League. I'm taking his pitches in the Japan League, yeah, but not the outcomes. I'm taking the outcomes from the Major League Baseball, and I'm saying, if those pitches were thrown to Major League hitters, what would have happened?
I'm curious. I want a prior study that says, let me take two pitchers who deliver the ball differently. Their arm angle's different.
Right.
The trajectory of the ball is somehow different. But we can still locate them. We can still control for where it hits that grid.
I expanded my answer to also include the trajectory of the pitch, because we now have TrackMan data. So I'm going to say, if I have I'll do a nearest neighbor match. I will find all pitches within some trajectory radii of this pitch.
Okay,
I'll look at batting averages. As a matter of fact, once I have the whole trajectory, I don't really need where it lands in the grid, because that would include that.
Okay.
So now I'm going to...
But now my prior question's smaller, but I think it's still interesting. It's like, okay, now it's probably even more interesting. For identically trajectoried pitchers, or at least close, and maybe you need identical, maybe you can't get identical, I don't know, but... guys do deliver those balls in different ways. And my understanding is that, you know, if a guy that delivers a ball by hand in a way that camouflages what he's doing is much more successful than a pitcher that doesn't do that. And so for the exact same pitch, just the transparency of the delivery is going to make a big difference, possibly. So there's the previous analysis, Eric, is just to ask, okay, for this nearest neighbor set, how different is the success of the pitch?
So this is great. Let's continue the discussion. So what I'll do now,
I think this is a really great way. I mean, essentially what I think you're kind of constructing here is the extent that we can kind of basically, for a particular season that this pitcher's had in the Japanese baseball league, what would his analogous, given the exact, conditioning on the exact pitches he threw, what would have been his kind of, what would have been his expected outcome against major league hitting and with major league fielding behind him as opposed to, and all this type of stuff,
So
it's kind of a retrospective sort of like, here's the major league equivalent of what he did in his season.
And I'm going to play one other thing, just to be clear. Yeah. So, I can always, this is one of those things where I love doing with when I teach students, because whatever answer you give, I can always change my answer to incorporate it, which is a good thing. So what I'll do is I'll create a typology of pitchers. So now I'm going to look at trajectory by typology of pitcher, and I'm going to extend my analysis to include that.
Okay, but now I want to add
something
as well.
Now I have sparse data, maybe, and I have challenges there.
I'm about to make it sparser,
okay.
And this is also the virtue of modeling. When you're forced to write down everything that matters, you start realizing more things matter than you think. So, for example, now I just wonder how much of a pitcher's effectiveness is strategy and choices he makes about when he pitches what.
Wait, remember, I'm having the catcher make that decision for
him. I don't think you can. I don't. If you're doing the analysis that you kind of led us to, and Shane just now got animated.
Was Andy Pettit and Greg Maddux, were they savvy because of their catchers?
No.
They just had Hall of Fame catchers?
No, but I'm going to let my algorithm determine that pitch.
That's not okay.
No. What's okay about it is I'm not actually answering I'm not answering exactly the question that Shane posited, which is, had they thrown these pitches to major leagues? I'm using these to calibrate how effective they are and the other players for a certain set of pitches. I'm going to let someone else call the pitches, and then their balls come in at their certain speed and trajectories. So they don't have to be the ones calling the pitches.
Okay, but you're robbing people. It still raises the question of how important is that in a pitcher's success, because you're taking that away when some pitchers are good at it. If it matters, the ones who are good at it, you're robbing them of that ability, and the ones who aren't good at it, you're improving their ability. So the question is, how much does that matter? The strategy, the setting the batter up stuff.
And again, if we're kind of using this, which I think you're probably building towards, to actually kind of project what they would do in the major leagues, the extra sparsity is also, you know, the less than comparable pitchers like that are doing this at 21 years old is zero. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, he 20 years old in Japanese league, so we'd love to sort of see what he would do in an American game. But I just want to say he threw a 19 strikeout perfect game when he was 20 years old in the Japanese, like just last year, 19 strikeout perfect game. And so,
by the way, I'll just comment.
How many other pitchers in baseball history have ever done that at age 20? In a professional league.
So this is a beautiful point of discussion. I'll give you my answer, which again can answer any of your questions. Age don't matter, because the ball don't know what age you are, and they're not calling the pitches.
Shane,
no. Under my model,
I know.
Under my state of the world.
But now we're going past your model to ask what the value.
Yeah,
of the player is.
You couldn't use your model to project this person's next 5 years.
I'm not
in
doing exactly,
any league
exactly.
Yeah.
What do y'all expect from the anything to pay attention to in the game tonight, or anything you're excited about other than the potential Ohtani Trout matchup?
No, I mean, I think that I mean, seeing Ohtani and Trout in an actual playoff game, let's enjoy this. We haven't seen this before.
Is Ohtani? I know he's not starting.
He can pitch in relief.
Wouldn't it be great if he pitched to Trout?
Yeah.
They have to do that, even if the game's already decided. For the internationalization of the sport, he must pitch to Mike Trout.
So they're gonna pinch hit Trout, or they can pull him in at whenever Trout comes up.
Correct. But
that's when they need to put Ohtani in, just for the spectatorness of it. For the circus of it.
They have to.
I bet they won't, though.
No, they won't.
That's a shame.
No, and I mean,
because they want to win. Apparently this is one of these.
No, and I mean, there's some interesting strategic stuff that I think is interesting. I mean, I wanted to actually ask you there, because you watch way more baseball even than I do. So last night in the game, kind of in terms of a strategic decision, bottom of the ninth inning, there's Team Japan were down by a run. They got to, you know, Ohtani's on second, and Yoshida, who's new Red Sox outfielder,
walked him
to get to first.
Intentionally.
And Yoshida, up until that point, was probably the best player, certainly in that game for Japan, and has been, you know, he's basically broken the record in terms of RBIs in this tournament. They pinch run him for a fast runner. It immediately paid off. Because, you know, the next guy hit a double, and, like, the pinch runner almost caught up to Ohtani going around the bases. And Ohtani's not slow himself. So, I mean, but I wonder kind of, like, would a major league team take out the best hitter for a pinch runner in that situation? Was the winning run not even the tying run?
Yeah, I would say the answer is probably no. Because, again, if you tie the game but don't win the game, your best hitter's now out of the game.
Mm-hmm. How many outs?
There were no outs at the time.
Which way does that go?
Yeah. So what's also interesting to that is the pinch hitter, the guy who came in, actually said, I considered bunting, because he had not been playing well during the rest of the playoffs. So he was saying, maybe we're better off with second and third and one out.
But you're still happy to have the pinch runner on second in that situation.
You're happy to have the pinch runner.
Y'all watch a lot more baseball than me, but I have the opposite intuition that it seems to be that managers are often doing everything they can in that moment to maximize
something, as opposed to the longer term. But let's just say you take we don't even know. I don't know how fast the guy was that was on Yoshida, right? The guy that's going to be joining the Red Sox.
Yeah.
I don't know how fast he is comparably, because then you have to say to yourself, what are the distribution of hits that would make a difference? Like, obviously, if the guy hits a home run, there's no differential. Obviously, if it's a deep single, there's going to be a run scored, a man on third, no matter what.
Yeah.
So it's a small fraction of the zone of hits. This happened to be one of them, where the difference is going to be that large.
I agree with this analysis and would probably, you know, naively make the same decision. But it just seems to me that you do see managers make these kinds of substitutions, just getting a little marginal bump pretty regularly, especially in these. I mean, this is the semifinal. This is elimination. This is everything. Mm-hmm.
No, playoff games.
Yeah, and the other thing that was exciting about it, something we texted about last night too, was, you know, it's not just that the game was exciting, but think about how the win probability swung just in that ninth inning. I mean, I would imagine that Mexico was the favorite even after Ohtani led off with a double. Like, I would still think they're the favorite slightly. Because, you know,
I think they probably had a greater than 50% chance of winning prior to the game-ending hit.
I even think prior to the game-ending hit, even when it was first and second with no outs,
agreed.
I think they were likely. And so I think that's what made it extraordinarily exciting. And look, for a lot of these players, it may look, Trey Turner said this for the U.S. team when the U.S. was down 7-5 and he hit a grand slam in the eighth inning. This is Trey Turner.
What a tournament that guy's had, by
the way. He said it was the most important hit of his career.
Amazing.
That's what he said.
Hey, by the way, I think he was batting ninth in that. What position does he bat in his regular gig?
Well, he's about to join a new team, the Phillies, where, I mean, he'd probably...
First. I think he's replacing Schwarber. I think they're taking Schwarber, who, remember...
Oh, my goodness. A lineup with him and Schwarber and Bryce Harper.
No, but Schwarber bats 210. Do you want a 210 hitter batting first? No, I think they're batting Trey Turner first.
Okay.
So that's going to be a ridiculous lineup.
No, and I mean, again, the Philly, you know, it's the U.S. team is basically all-stars, and three of their regular starters are Phillies.
Well, the last...
Trey Turner, Schwarber, and Realmuto.
Well, that's my question to you. How can this Japan team, what's the statistical argument that this Japan team can beat the Major League All-Stars? Does that mean that this Japan team, like all of these players, we know Ohtani's in the Major Leagues, but and one of them's joining the Red Sox. But I mean, on paper, how can this happen?
Okay, so this it's a little bit like the Ryder Cup thing for years where this to the outsider it feels this way.
Yeah.
The U.S. team was always more loaded than the European team, but the European team played more like a team. They hung out together.
But this is baseball.
I know. But golf is singular competition in the way that baseball is. In those two sports, the esprit de corps among teammates is not really supposed to matter. If it does matter here, Japan has an advantage because they've been playing together for many more weeks. They care more about this. It's in the culture there much more than this game is in the American culture. I'm not saying this is going to matter. I'm saying that would be the argument, and it's not supposed to matter in the Ryder Cup, and it did.
And I will say, I think it does. You know, I mean, I think, A, that on the hitting side of things, the All-Stars of Japan are not much lower than the All-Stars in America. So that's one thing. You know, and obviously some of them are even better, you know, the best right. among the hitters in America. And also what's even to the extent that there's even an advantage to American hitters on the hitting side, it's very much counterbalanced by the fact that every pitcher, every ex-ace pitcher of Japanese descent is actually participating in this tournament. Whereas on the pitching side, that's really where the Major League Baseball teams are not, you know, either the players themselves or the teams, there's not nearly as much of strong pitching. I mean, Adam Wainwright started the semifinal game.
Correct.
For America. And I mean, a great, incredible career, but I mean...
Yeah, come on. He's not in the top 10 pitchers.
Where's Gerrit Cole? Where's I mean, we could name probably 10 U.S. pitchers that should be... You know
who would be ahead of
who would be ahead of him. So you know, I think that's really kind of part of it as well.
What are your rooting interests tonight? I think Shane's pulling for Japan.
I would be happy either way. I'm actually going to pull for the U.S.
I know you wanted Japan in the finals, and presumably you wanted the U.S. in the finals. So you got exactly the matchup.
No, I wanted Ohtani against Trout. That is something I've been cheering for since this tournament began. And I wanted to see both those guys as much as possible in a playoff environment because we unfortunately have not seen that yet in Major League Baseball. But But I guess I think I'm probably – well, it'll be, you know, once the game starts, I'll really know who I'm cheering for. But I think it'll be U.S.
Right. I'm obviously going to root for the U.S. But I always had the other counterfactual question I asked myself is, suppose the Buccaneers were playing tonight. Suppose it was during the NFL season the Buccaneers were playing. Who would I be watching? That would be the first question I would ask myself. Or suppose there were a Sixer playoff game tonight. I think this would probably be on my alternate screen. Like, I would probably have this on my – I'm a multi-screen guy. Mm-hmm. But I think the big screen would go on the Buccaneers, or the big screen would go on an NBA playoff game. This is just – maybe it's to Cade's point. This is just not that important to me. I won't lose any sleep if the U.S. loses.
Well, good fun coming up tonight, the World Baseball Classic Final, U.S. and Japan. And that has been our first quarter. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball, the show where sports and statistics collide. This is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics here at the Wharton School, and I'm here with my co-host, professor of statistics, Shane Jensen. Some combination of the two of us and Cade Massey and Adi Weiner are here every week here on Wharton Moneyball. Well, Shane, as we've always said, the best thing about our jobs is we get to interview people that are actually practicing experts of analytics and analytics in our favorite topic, sports. And today is no exception. We're joined by Mike Kelly. Mike's a hockey analyst specializing in analytics for both the NHL Network and Sports Logic. Mike, welcome back to Wharton Moneyball.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Always happy to talk to you guys.
So I'm going to start with a question, but then I have to turn it over to Mr. Canada here. Sorry, Dr. Canada here, Shane Jensen. This seems like a historic season in a number of ways. What of the historic things that might happen this season in the NHL sticks out to you the most?
It's a phenomenal question, and you're right. What sticks out to me the most is Connor McDavid and what he's doing this season. The points that he's on pace to score, the goal scoring, already breaking a career high for himself. We haven't seen an offensive season like this since Mario Lemieux in the mid-90s.
So can you give us a sense, Mike, of, like, they've roughly played, what, in the low 60s in terms of games? Like, how many points has Connor McDavid scored? How great a season are we talking about here? Like, one of the top 10, 20 all-time? Where are his numbers?
Yeah, so he's played 65 games. He's scored 124 points, which is just over 1.9 per game. That type of scoring, like I said, hasn't happened since Mario in the mid-90s. If he gets to 150 points, I believe, this is the top of my head, so I believe there's been six players who have done that. It's a very short list of players who have scored 150 points in an NHL season.
Actually, so, just...
Yeah, and I think I can kind of pipe in here. I think if you project him to like 155 or 106 points, which he's kind of right in line with right now, it's just Lemieux and Gretzky ahead of him. It's like it would be like something like the 13th or 14th highest offensive season.
Yeah,
but it's only Gretzky and Lemieux seasons above that.
Yeah, so other than Wayne and Mario, and that's as elite company as you can possibly have. Steve Yzerman's the next highest at 155. So could Connor get there? Absolutely, he's kind of in line for that. So other than Wayne and Mario, he could end up having the most prolific offensive season of a player in NHL history. And to do that today in the way that the game has evolved and, you know, goaltenders, the save percentages aren't what they were, you know, 10, 20 years ago. But they're still some of the best athletes, you know, in the world at what they do. And to do that now, and the thing that always impressed me, and you try to put this into context, and you guys, you know this, right? With a mathematical background, you can look at average scoring rates across seasons and adjust for era. But the other thing that you can do is just look at how much a player has outscored the other people he competes against in his era. And, you know, Wayne did it at an exceptional level and rate. And we can all say, oh, scoring was up in the 80s. Yeah, well, nobody even came close to what he did in his era. What Connor McDavid's doing, he's got 124 points. His teammate, who he connects on goals with often, Leon Draisaitl, has 96. Nikita Kucherov's at 88. So when you go off of his team, 124 to 88 is the gap now, and we still have almost, you know, just under 20 games left.
Yeah, Mike, can you kind of speak to sort of like, I mean, I think you're already kind of implying that, you know, this is more about how outlying Connor McDavid is than it is some kind of like trend in overall scoring. But it is notable, at least to me, that we're also seeing one of the most prolific offensive performances by a defenseman this year that hasn't mm-hmm. been seen in, say, 30 years or so as well. I put those two things together. Naively, I might sort of assume that just kind of we're entering a new kind of 80s, 90s kind of scoring era. Are we, or is this really just more about these two players being so outlying?
A bit of both, but mainly the latter, I would say. And yeah, scoring rates have gone up recently. Shot quality has gone up. And I think analytics are a driver of this. I think it's a direct result. You look at kind of when analytics started to become prominent in the NHL, and some of the methods go back decades. You know, Scotty Bowman was doing what we would call analytics in a very early stage in the 60s and 70s. But the real prominence of analytics kind of mid-2000, the value of shot quality, that's what we're starting to see now, is teams really emphasizing that, and players as well. What Erik Karlsson's doing, also bordering on historic, he has 62 points in 64 games at even strength. The only defensemen who have ever scored that many even strength points in a season are Coffey, Orr, and Larry Robinson. So he's already one of four to do it, and he still has close to 20 games left. He's on pace to finish with 79, which would tie him with Bobby Orr for the third most ever in a season. Also historic.
So how do you measure, Mike? This is back to the original question I asked you. I could see at least three historic things potentially happening this season. You mentioned Connor McDavid. You mentioned Shane just mentioned Erik Karlsson. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have the Bruins, who as a team may end up setting the record for the most all-time points. What would make something, whether you want to talk about it from an analytics perspective, like maybe it's the gap from there to the second most, maybe it's just how many standard deviations away from the mean it is. How in your mind do you pick what's really outlying? Is it the number of years since we've seen something like this? One can imagine a lot of measures. I'm just wondering how you think about it.
Yeah, it's not the number of years, because you only have to go back to 2019 to see a team that had a similar season, and that was Tampa Bay. They won 60-plus games, and they won no playoff games that year. They got swept by Columbus, which, you know, all the Bruins fans that I know and work with, I like to jab them with that every now and then when they get a little too high on their horse. So I don't think we're going to see that this year with Boston. But
I was just up in Boston last weekend for the Sloan Conference and talking to people. They're very, very excited about the Bruins, but every single one of them remembers that Tampa Bay season. It was in their mind, certainly.
Oh, yeah, they know. I know. I was sorry I had to miss it this year. I've been the last few years, and it's such a great event. They know for sure. This team, though, like somebody asked me at the NHL Network last week, is there a weakness? And it made me think about 2019. And I did a really in-depth playoff preview on Columbus, Tampa Bay. And I remember thinking, you can forecheck Tampa Bay, force them into some mistakes. There were little nuanced areas. I didn't think at all enough to win a playoff series against them, but you could find these small things. I haven't gone as deep yet with Boston, but I don't see it. I mean, their goalie is going to win the Vezina Trophy. And even when you separate team defense from isolated goaltending impact, goal saved above expected, he's right there. He's been brilliant. Defensively, they're great. Offensively, special teams, up and down the lineup, it's incredible. So Colorado had one of the most dominant playoff years ever last year. They only lost four playoff games. They were a juggernaut. We'll see what Boston can do. This could end up being as impressive.
I asked a question to Shane at the end of last week. I'd love to hear, Mike, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Is there a chance that because the Bruins have the opportunity to set a historic regular season, that they don't rest their players an appropriate amount? And when the playoffs come, whether it's players are injured, players aren't properly rested, do you see any trade-off between, let's call it, pursuing this record and their possible performance in the playoffs? Or am I overplaying that, you know, standard narrative?
I think it would get overplayed in general in hockey. It's different than other sports in that sense. You don't typically see teams rest guys leading into the playoffs. Maybe the last game of the season, even maybe the last couple, if something's nagging a guy, but you really don't see it. And I know a lot of teams, you want to be going in on the right note. You want to have good chemistry. So I don't think we're going to see a scenario where in the last week, you know, Boston's resting a bunch of regulars. And it won't be because they're chasing any type of record. You just don't really see it in hockey.
Mike, I want to come back to something you mentioned before, which is kind of, you know, talking about how you sort of see analytics as driving some of the recent kind of, like, say, I guess, improvements in offensive performance or offensive team strategy. Do you think that, you know, are analytics kind of more likely to have a positive impact on offense compared to defense? I The reason I bring this up is I think about baseball and how pitching's the kind of proactive activity and hitting's the reactive activity. And so analytics and strategy almost necessarily have a greater impact in pitching. Do you kind of think of offensive and defensive in hockey in that same kind of proactive versus reactive way?
I think that's a fair point, mainly because we know a lot more about offense than we do defense at this point in the current stage of analytics. There are things intuitively that we will infer about defense that we can't measure or just started to be able to measure. You know, what's publicly available, if you wanted to measure defense, you're kind of going on impacts. What happens when a player is on the ice versus when he isn't? It doesn't really tell you anything about a player specifically. What we can do at companies like mine at SportLogic as a third-party data supplier is we can measure defensive events, but those are events that occur around the puck. You block a pass, a stick check, a puck battle win. What puck and player tracking can now, and this is very new, and will be able to do is measure things like defensive spacing and where players are on the ice. But we're years away from understanding those impacts. So because I think we've been able to measure and quantify offense so much longer and in so much more detail, if you're going to use analytics to try to gain a strategic advantage, you'd be able to do that more effectively. That's one of the things that fascinates me about where this is all going, is understanding how you can use tools that are kind of newly available to quantify defense and improve defensively. I still maintain, because everyone's pushing for offense and that's the way the league's going, that's great. What if you're a team that can still defend really well? I still think that can give you a huge edge.
Particularly if the other teams, you know, there's almost an arbitrage in there, perhaps, where the other teams, if there becomes such a sort of, you know, push towards kind of more offensive, like minded kind of strategy or team building, that might leave a lot of value out there for a team to take kind of a, you know, an against the market kind of a, yep, you know, strategy to team construction and how they play the game. I guess I want to talk or ask a little bit more about kind of like, you know, analytics. You know, you've been talking a little bit about kind of how analytics, you know, you're probably 3, 4, 5 years out from some of the newest like kind of data affecting, you know, roster construction and our ability to better measure defense. More immediately, what do you kind of see as coming down the pipeline relatively soon in terms of like how you see kind of data presented, like in the media and stuff like that? Are we, you know, I mean, the NFL and NBA, they're experimenting a lot with kind of adding analytics and data visualizations more into their production and telecast. Do you kind of see that happening in hockey as much, or are there certain things you're excited about in that kind of domain?
Yeah, it is. It's one of my primary roles at SportLogic is overseeing what we do in that area with our media partners. I'm proud to say that we have really helped grow that in hockey and in all the partners that we work with, whether it's regional or national. And, you know, as someone who's, you know, works in this field, I don't watch sports hoping to see data. Like as a sports fan, what I watch and I want to be entertained. I want to be informed. And data can do that. It can entertain and inform if it's presented effectively. So that's where I watch the NFL. I see, because next gen stats is so far along, and you get someone like Chris Collinsworth, who is directly involved. He's to me the gold standard for how to do this stuff.
Right.
Because he's not giving a math lesson. He's not presenting charts and graphs. He is interpreting it so effectively, and he uses it at the right time. He's storytelling, really effective storytelling. And that to me is the power of information and what you can do in hockey and in any other sport. And so that's what we do with our partners, is we don't inundate them with data. We don't say, hey, here's some numbers. That's kind of cool, right? We look for areas where we can provide a meaningful insight into the game. And I'll give you an example. Last year, playoffs, Andre Vasilevsky in the regular season, it allowed an inordinate amount of goals to his high blocker side. And I can't tell you exactly why, but they have ex-goalies and ex-players that can get into that. We follow this through the playoffs, and it continued to be a theme. It's a departure point for great storytelling. That's where I see data being valuable.
So we're here on Wharton Moneyball. This is Eric Bradlow, professor of marketing and statistics, and I'm here with my co-host Shane Jensen. We're talking to Mike Kelly. Mike is a hockey analyst specializing in analytics for both the NHL Network and his current company as well, Sports Logic. So Mike, let me ask you, one strategy, we were talking about the Boston Bruins before, and you said you couldn't really notice a weakness. Could you see a strategy? Would the following ever work in hockey, similar to what happens in soccer? When you're the worst team, you just pack it in. You pack it in, hope for these, you know, few opportunities that may come in between where maybe you get a breakaway, maybe you get a penalty call, so you now have a power play going. Would a pack it in strategy, do you ever see a team going to try that against what's clearly maybe a superior team like the Bruins?
I think you nailed it. I think that's it in a lot of cases. You're absolutely right. We see that year over year at the World Junior Tournament as an example, when you get teams like an Austria or teams that are not nearly as talented as a Canada or a Sweden or USA, whatever it might be. It's hang four guys back and look for counter strike opportunities. Really. You're trying not to allow any offense and you're looking to counterpunch because you can't press it. You don't have the ability. And I'll go back to that 2019 Columbus series. Two things that people might not know about Columbus in that year. One, they were a very good defensive team. They were top five in expected goals against. That's team defense. Number two, they scored more goals off the rush that year in the regular season than any team in the league. So what did they do? They hung back. They tried to get Tampa Bay caught overhandling the puck, making mistakes. And when they did, they counterattacked. And it worked really well for them to the point that they won that series in four games. So I think you really hit the nail on the head with it.
Yeah, I know that's interesting to kind of think about. And I think, I also kind of am always sort of, obviously with the playoffs kind of at least, and in front view now, thinking about, potential matchups or strategies to like slow down a team like the Bruins or any of the other kind of really contending teams, given that there's kind of a little bit of a disparity between the two leagues or the two sides of the league in terms of like, the top teams, how do you kind of this far out see the playoffs going? It's still a ways away, but we're past the trade deadline. So I think we can go into full playoff prediction mode now. How do you kind of see, what teams are you kind of keeping your most eye out in the West? And besides the Bruins, are there a couple teams that, we should really be looking at in the East?
Yeah, the top six in the East are kind of all juggernauts in one way or another. And it was an arms race at the trade deadline. They all loaded up to some degree other than Carolina, but Carolina's one of the top teams in the NHL right now as well. So I'm interested in a couple matchups because they're kind of locked in already. I've got a 96% chance that Tampa and Toronto play in the first round. That's kind of a given. 60% chance that the Rangers and the Devils play in the first round. So I'm already starting to look at those two and how these teams can find those inefficiencies against their opponent. The LA Kings is a team I've been saying, not getting a ton of buy-in from, people in hockey necessarily who are analysts as well in this yet, but they're an elite defensive team. They've had the worst goaltending in the NHL this season. So before the trade deadline, when they went out and got Jonas Korpisalo, who's been really good with Columbus this year, their goal saved above expected was pretty close to -1. So that's like starting a game down 1-0 every night. And it's hard to win like that. And they've been winning. That's how good they are. So now they get Korpisalo. I think they could surprise some people. And the Pacific isn't, that deep a division where maybe they could come out of it and be in a conference final. So I'm keeping an eye on them. I love the Devils too, how they play. Keeping an eye on them also.
So, Mike, let me ask you two final questions here. First, in hockey, most people might say it's a coin flip. There are eight teams, right, that make the playoffs in each conference. Mm-hmm. What probability, obviously it's going to be a number greater than 1 out of 8, that would you give the Boston Bruins to be in the finals? Like, how much different than just everyone has the same chance would you give them, even though they're having a historic season?
That's, I haven't looked at that yet. That's a really good question. I would still always take the field over any particular team.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking of the possibility you were going to give more than 50%. I was thinking, like, would you give them twice the average team, like a quarter, 25%, or is that even too much for you? I'm just trying to get an idea of how you think about what extraordinary performance means. And 2-1 versus everyone else is not bad. I'm just wondering how you think about it.
Yeah, I think about it more practically than maybe, you know, an average fan who would say, oh, Boston should win the cup this year, so it would be above 50. I don't think that, but... if you look at President's Trophy winners, so teams that finish first in the league. Now, again, there aren't teams doing what Boston's done really maybe ever, but they don't win the Stanley Cup very often. In fact, very rarely. I'd probably, you know, this is a bad thing to say on an analytics-based show because I'm not giving you some math here, but I'd probably ballpark it at around 20%.
That was basically, I think, Shane's number from last week as well. Okay. And maybe one last question for me, and then maybe Shane, I think, has one more as well. How much do matchups matter in the NHL? Like, could you ever imagine a team saying, maybe this is heretical, what I'm about to say, I'd rather be the 7 seed than the 6 seed because I'd rather play the 2 seed than the 3 seed given our matchups against it? Or is that, like, totally out of your mind kind of thinking in the NHL?
I don't know how they think about it, but it's real. No question about it. There's just some teams that match up better against other teams. I'll give you one example. Carolina, right? They've been a juggernaut all season, first in the Metropolitan Division. They have not matched up against the New York Rangers very well this season at all. And the Rangers' speed has given them trouble. Now, Carolina dumps pucks out, dumps pucks in more than anybody. They play a very specific type of game. And they're successful against most teams, but that's an example where, at least in the regular season, one team for one reason has given them trouble. And they've got a great goalie in Shesterkin as well in New York. It's absolutely a very real thing where you might be a 7 or 8 seed or a 6 seed, and you could give a top team more trouble than a 2 seed just because of the stylistic matchup. No question.
Yeah, and I guess I'll kind of close on just sort of a lament slash question about my Calgary Flames, who went from number one Pacific last year to probably missing the playoffs this year. I've been kind of tracking it, but I want an objective third party weighing in on just how much this season for them was kind of bad luck versus, you know, they just did not, the roster construction is not good, and they just really took a step back this year.
Yeah, there's some degree of luck in there. I was shocked by this. I thought they had every opportunity to be as good as last year, maybe even a bit better, because I was very high on Mackenzie Weegar. I thought the Huberto-Gaudreau would be, you know, 50-50-ish trade-off. And, you know, Kadri for Matthew Tkachuk, it's not apples to apples. But Markstrom and the goaltending has really sunk them in a lot of ways. That, to me, is number one. Number two, and this is corrected recently over the last month or so, but for most of the season, high shot volume, not a lot of quality in comparison. And it's tough to win in the league the way the game's played these days that way. So they haven't been scoring as much as they should as a result. Goaltending, like I said, is you've gone from a Vezina Trophy finalist to, you know, closer to the bottom of the league for goaltending this season as a team. It's tough to overcome those things. I think it should be very disappointing because the expectations were really high.
Well, Mike, Shane and I would like to thank you for joining us here on Wharton Moneyball. We've been talking to Mike Kelly. Mike's a hockey analyst specializing in analytics for both the NHL Network and Sports Logic. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at Mike Kelly NHL. Mike, thank you again for joining us here on Wharton Moneyball.
My pleasure. Really appreciate you having me.
Well, this has been another interview segment here on Wharton Moneyball. Please stay with us and join us right after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. We're just going to listen to Dion's music for a while. Ken Bassey hosting with the whole crew here in the studio. In studio, live of sorts. Business Radio Studios in the Huntsman Hall, Wharton School. Whole crew is here. Eric Bradlow is here. Audie Weiner is here. Shane Jensen is here. And our guest is here. Q3, another interview segment. Welcome onto the show for the first time, Thomas Dimitroff, famed longtime GM, Atlanta Falcons. Before that, personnel man with the New England Patriots. About to have heard about those guys. now CEO of Sumer Sports. Sumer burst onto the landscape in the last year, has been on a hiring spree of some of the very best people. Great fun. They have one of the great missions that we've heard about in our 10 years having these conversations. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, Thomas. Thank you.
I am honored. I've been listening to you guys here and there, and have so many great things being said about you all from Eric Eager and the likes. So thanks for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Can't wait to talk.
Absolutely. What are you thinking about this time of year? It's you know, football is already the, I'm sorry, baseball guys, the dominant sport in North America. And they've done a real nice job in recent years of taking over the offseason too. You know, you think we're still in the wake of the Super Bowl. We might not be paying attention. And yet, you know, I see your screen behind you is highlights of football. We're talking about free agency this week. That's just to fill the time between conversations about the draft. What are you paying attention to right now in March?
Well, I mean, normally in March, as a former general manager, my head is so wrapped up in trying to build teams, of course, and making big decisions and looking at the owner, taking big swallows during free agency and telling Arthur Blank over those many years, yes, sir, this is worth $30 million, $100 million, whatever it may be. I mean, look, these are interesting times for some of my contemporaries. I still call my buddies. We still talk about opportunities and potential, you know, situations around the league. It's interesting. A lot of people think that, you know, it's very protected. And I would say to most people, general managers, interestingly enough, as we know, it's pyramidal, right? So, you know, down in the bottom, that level at the bottom is providing information all the way up to the top to the head coach and the general manager. And the head coach and the general manager never want your people to talk to anyone. But as you're at the top of it, you're calling your buddies, your close ones, right? Okay. And you're discussing players, you're discussing potential trades, not collusion. Let me make sure I'm very clear about that. It's just, it's probably like in your business, right? From an academic standpoint, you're calling about white papers and studies and other amazing things you guys are doing in academia. And it means something to discuss, you know, what's out there. You learn around some of the greatest minds, I think, in football. And for me to ever have an opportunity, whether your fan base likes him or not, I mean, I think Bill Belichick is one of the most brilliant coaches, of course, out there. Mm-hmm. And I always enjoyed reaching out to him during this time of year. Mm. Even though, if you guys remember, he dissuaded me from trading up for Julio Jones. Mm. He said that literally you will be plagued with that move the rest of your career, just because he was looking out for me. But the point is, there's a lot of discussion amongst a lot of us, and it's kind of fascinating this time of year.
Mm-hmm. As in the GM seat, you have to worry about a lot more than the rest of us have to worry about, even compared to what you had to worry about as national scout or head of college scouting. What do you think the analytics community is missing in these conversations? One of the things I've really enjoyed about your podcast with Eric is that you guys kind of have this, the give and take between the analytics guy and the non-analytics guy. And I think it's really valuable to have someone 12 years GM experience who's interested in analytics and enthusiastic about analytics, but has a broader perspective than just analytics. So what, as we kind of represent the analytics community here, what do you think we miss? And football analytics community has gotten big and kind of rabid in the last 10 years. What do you think we need to do better, think differently about? What are we missing?
Well, I want to lead in by saying there is no question there is going to be an amazing shift in the NFL toward understanding and grasping and welcoming analytics, right? There's definitely an evolutionary element going on right now. A lot of these GMs out there and rising executives want to know more and know that it can be helpful and know that you can use analytics, and all of that criminally underutilized data that's out there for these teams is right at their feet. And they know that if they augment it properly, they know this, that they could make them their decisions, their interaction with the owner and the head coach exponentially better. But they too many times just don't have the space, the headspace and the time to really dig into it.
Really?
So what I would say is I personally believe, gentlemen, we could bring 32 general managers around this table right now. And first of all, everyone would raise their hands and say, A, this is not an exact science, which we all know. That's not rocket science, of course. B, they know that they are sitting on the edge of their seat and shooting from the side, you know, from their hip at times on moves and acquisitions that a lot of us think, okay, they're really, really dialed in on that move. We could all raise our hands and say, oh my God, really? We actually dodged a bullet on A, B, and C and X, Y, and Z because we just weren't as thought out as we should have been mm-hmm. or could have been. Mm-hmm. However, mm-hmm. that same 32 would say to me, guys, they would say, I'm also going to raise my hand and say, of the major mistakes, and I do it myself, that I made in the league, they were not on the player, they were on the person. This is, I mean, everyone's always trying to measure the subjective, right? But when those guys tell me that, that's a really, really revealing issue that we have. So my feeling has always been, okay, let's get better about the Vic Beasleys of the world. Do you guys remember who Vic Beasley was?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So Defensive player for the Falcons.
Right, and we drafted him. Dan Quinn and I drafted him. We thought he was going to be the heir apparent and going to be with us for 3 and 4 contracts. Unbelievable athlete, unbelievable numbers. I mean, the data on him as we studied it, we thought, no problem. This guy's the guy. Looked great. Never drank in his life. Never partied in his life. And yet we knew that he was lacking in passion and drive and sort of dedication to the sport, as good as he was. Remember, we draft him. He wins the sack title the year we get to the Super Bowl. We get our butts kicked, unfortunately, in that game against Bill and the Patriots. The next year he comes back and he just fizzles, right? The passion, again, wonderful soul, but the passion was just not there. Mm-hmm. We missed on the passion. Interestingly enough, we thought, our coaches thought, this is a really interesting thing. Don't get me started on coaches. And I have a lot of love for a lot of coaches. But there are also coaches out there that try to tell us as GMs, I can change that guy from being an arbitrary number is a 4 for us, right? In our grading scale.
Yeah.
I can change him from being average passion to being a six or a seven, which is good or very good.
Yeah.
Categorically, I know him. I know his coach from Clemson. I know this. I know that. And sure as I'm not supposed to swear on here. Right?
You can.
Shinola.
Sure as Shinola as it is, he ends up fizzling out because we knew what we saw there and we overlooked it and we thought we could overrun it with all the data that we had and all the great stuff that he brought to the table, and we missed. So a long-winded way of saying, gentlemen, I just think if we as a football crowd can come and sit down with the Eric Eagers of the world, and I tell Eric all the time, I said, Eric, if I ever got another opportunity in the NFL, there is no question that I would have a data scientist beside me as one of my main guys, whether it's a chief of staff or whether it was an assistant GM, because there is so much discussion that we can have, open-minded discussion that we could have, that I think could open up doors beyond what anyone's doing right now.
Well, Thomas, I just want to respond. I mean, I know Eric well, and I know the spreadsheets, but I don't think passion is a variable on that list. So if you're going to use it and ask a data scientist to use it, you're going to have a way to measure it, and you have to go back and check and make sure that it's working the way you think. And do you think that's possible? I mean, this is one of the intangibles that hangs out there as important but isn't being measured.
One of the things that I've discussed about this is it's a really good question. And I bust our guys a lot because I'm like, we pay you a lot of money, Eric. So even though it is way out there and almost undescribable or undetectable, at least in our minds right now, let's find something out there in our quest for advanced analytics in leadership and passion and desire. And let's see how we can. It's never going to be perfect, of course, far from that. But my feeling has always been, let's find some elements that are going to indicate passion, desire, leadership, even if it's a percentage of whatever it is. I would rather that be the case than not have anything at all. I've said that in a lot of these areas from a former, like I'm a scout at the core, and we're in the middle of creating these what we're calling our football metric trees. And probably if you take a quarterback's metric tree that has 15 metrics, 5 of those are objective. And unfortunately, 10 of them might be subjective, right? Or, mm-hmm. or maybe it's half.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know the objective ones? So let's kick the crap out of those, right? Let's kill those. Let's be perfect, as close to perfect as we can. And then those other 5 or 7 that we're looking at, let's try to find levels that we can dig at to potentially reveal something. And that's my answer to your question, because I know it's not, I know it's really, really complicated. But do we take passion and do we do discipline? Do we look at discipline and start looking at the penalties that someone has? Whether that's procedure or whether that's rough play, whether that's drug issues that he's had and he's been busted three different times in the NFL, whatever it may be, how can we pull something together to give us some indication of what discipline would be for that individual?
Thomas, in the athlete you were talking about before, do you think there's anything on the field that would have revealed the lack of passion, or was it exclusively off-field stuff that would have revealed it? Like if we tracked his motion in some way, could you
say
see
like
effort?
Speed or something on
is
each play?
Anything like that on the field, or is it purely what
love
he does?
That. Off the- yes. I remember being up in the box with Arthur Blank, so I would sit up in his suite. That wasn't the easiest thing. I love Arthur, don't get me wrong, but I'm between Arthur Blank and Rich McKay, our president, right? And I'm thinking every day of my life I'm getting skewered by the national media, mainly local media, excuse me, just because that's how it is. And I have these two gentlemen there, especially Arthur, who would be nudging me and asking me questions. And I remember, I don't know how many times when we looked at a guy like that we drafted so high and we expected big things. And I saw him either sauntering on the backside or not necessarily throwing his body around and what we call being reckless. And that's not necessarily the right way to describe it. There is no question that it was very revealing to me. Even early on, I started thinking, what's wrong with him? Is he injured? And then I'd go back to the trainer later on. The trainer would say, no, he's fine. He's wow. Actually, everything is great with him. Wow. So it's a really good question.
So Thomas, one of the things the old statisticians don't really have jokes or sayings, but if we had one, we'd said, you hire a statistician to give you an uncertainty estimate, not a mean prediction. So when you guys rated players, did you ask scouts or even your models to say, here's how certain we are about it? Because we were just talking about the first round of the NFL draft this year. I'm sure Sumer's looking at this as well. There are these four quarterbacks. Besides just which one of them, like, here's our rating on the player, do you give some sort of uncertainty? Like, this person could be as good as, I'll make it up, Andrew Luck, and they could be as bad as Ryan Leaf, which, of course, would be a very wide interval. How do you think about uncertainty?
Yeah, we definitely do discuss that in our draft rooms, and we discuss it all the way down the line. So as I was talking about, working from the bottom up, our scouts would present what you're talking about. They'd not only present their evaluation of the player as well as, the entire scouting staff that, who was actually evaluating that player. They would talk about that. And then we would go through that idea of, what is the probability of this player with their issues? This is a good question. What's the probability of this player picking up our offense? What's the probability of this player, again, suffering an injury? What's the probability of this player not necessarily reacting to our coaching and showing that laissez-faire element that we saw at Clemson sometimes, if we're talking about, Vic Beasley? We would, but the problem is, and if I could ever do it again, and if I were ever to be in a situation to do it again, I would definitely become, much more driven towards, figuring out the quantitative side, right? I think we in football way too often, we just kind of throw it out there in sort of a subjective, lighthearted discussion, and there'll be some back and forth banter about it, and someone will use a comparison. We'll all laugh and we'll move on and we'll say, okay, well, let's just keep an eye on this guy, right? Think about how much money we're about ready. The NFL owners are about ready in the next 5 years, over the next 5 years, to spend over $1 billion in salaries for their respective players. Mm-hmm. $1 billion. And we are still doing things that are nowhere near as exact as they could be. And that's why I'm here today talking to you all, because I do believe if I can in some way not only help the business be successful, but help this rising group of executives who are in the spot now and say, mm-hmm. look, what you need to do is not poo-poo the whole idea of analytics and say, no, at the core, this is football, and we never need to get away from football, but understand how it can truly augment your abilities. To me, that is if you're not looking at it that way, it's incredibly short-sighted. I mentioned this. We were at the Super Bowl, Eric and I, very quickly. We had 36 hits there, right? We were doing all kinds of really cool interviews with a lot of people. I wasn't trying to be a tough guy about this. Interestingly enough, I had just finished my last payment from Arthur Blank. believe it or not. By the way, I don't know if you guys know that. They hang that over your head as owners and organizations. You can't be derogatory until your payments are up. So it was my first time being in media when I wasn't being paid any longer. I did say, and I said it respectfully to the owners, just like I think it's the president and I think it's the general manager's responsibility, I definitely think it's the owner's responsibility to understand all of this underutilized data needs to be put into working effect here, mm-hmm. because we are just skimming the bottom of it all, or mm-hmm. skimming the top, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
So you now talk to all teams, more or less. You're talking throughout the league from your position outside of the building. What are you seeing in terms of the extent to which it is integrated? Because my sense is that it doesn't work if the quants are off to one side, even if you really invest in them. If they're not working with the scouts, if they're not part of those draft board meetings, like maybe not full-fledged members, Thomas, but dang near, if the model and the quants are always seen as other, then really it doesn't, it's still not going to work. It's not the best the building can do. Is there anybody, we don't need names, but what's your sense of, to what extent are they being integrated? Or are they just still kind of, ghettoed off to the side?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because since I've obviously been involved in this over the last year and that much, I've always been interested in being on the front end of the curve again, not having the time to really focus on it as much as I'd like. And I would count on our quants downstairs. Unfortunately, I had a downstairs in the basement office, which kind of lends itself to what you're talking about. Although we put a lot of money into the new office, by the way, in Atlanta. I was so excited about it. But what I would say is, I know there are a lot of people that are open, and we've moved from a couple, in organizations to, full-fledged 5, 6, and 7 departments full of really good data people and systems people that I'm really actually proud of the NFL that we're moving in that direction. The problem, however, is back to what I've said to you time-wise. If I'm sure that Jack probably mentioned this and Jack Jones as well as Eric, and I don't know if Saban's been on here with you guys since he's joined, but too often these organizations bring people in their quants. For instance, let's say they had 3 to 5, they're not focused on the roster optimization. Again, sorry if I'm repeating myself. They are so focused on helping the coaches out. They're running around in their own ways, unfortunately, with a sort of a gopher approach, right? And it used to kind of piss me off because I thought, we have so much intelligence here. The last thing I want is the receiver coach or the linebacker coach to be tugging our people away who are working on models to help us build this team, taking it seriously. And they're tugging them down in their room. They're out there doing some menial tasks at times that is taking away from, the general intellect of our organization. So I don't mean to kind of get off on a tangent here, but I think too often that happens. The teams that are really open to it, I mean, of course, Philly, of course, Cleveland, of course, I mean, I'm a big fan of Eric DaCosta and what Baltimore does. The Kwesi thing, I'm sure you guys have talked about that. This is a huge deal for the NFL. Kwesi has to come in. There's a lot of pressure on him in the quant world. There's a lot of pressure on him in a lot of different ways. He's the guy that has the background in of course, data and analytics. Basketball guy goes there. He hires Ryan Grigson, who's a former GM, by the way, one of the best winning records, although albeit only 4 years before he got fired. He's his right hand guy. Mm-hmm. There are people out there that are, I will tell you, there are football people out there that are biting their nails, hoping that that's not going to be the wave of the future. They're hoping that it's going to be switched around.
Because the football guy's number two and the analytics guy is number one.
There's some worry out there about it. Right. But here's the interesting thing. You all remember this because you've been doing it a long time. Sashi Brown was the guy that was going to take us into another world as far as the people that are open to using analytics and data. And he's obviously with the Ravens now. He's a president. But when he was the GM, what we call, pulling or ripping the tags off the board with his head coach, Hugh Jackson, never worked.
Right.
And that put the sort of quant movement kind of back 3, 4, or 5 years.
That's interesting.
This is a big deal right now. Mm-hmm. And Andrew Berry's doing a great job for everyone. I also, however, like the fact that, and Andrew played football, I think, at Harvard, right? I believe it was
some
Harvard.
Some goofy Ivy League school, yeah. But he did play college football. Yeah. That's right, some college football.
Sorry. But I love the fact that you have guys like Howie and you have guys like Eric DaCosta. Howie, not as much, but Eric, who's a football guy through and through and believes in the movement, because that's what's going to have the owners won over, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to have the entire organization won over versus, you know, someone thinking, well, Kwesi got that job and just watch in 2 years, something's going to spin out.
Right.
We need success there for all of us, right?
Right. So quick pitch. Kwesi is going to be one of our speakers at the Wharton People Analytics Conference. 2 weeks. 2 weeks from tomorrow, Kwesi is going to be in. It'll be fun to talk analytics with him. Thomas, let's talk a little bit about the 23 draft. You know, we're always disproportionately obsessed with quarterbacks, and every now and then we're blessed with an especially rich quarterback draft. And this seems like a pretty good one. We've got four guys that people expect to go at the top, somewhere in the top half maybe of the first round. We have already seen some moves, some big choices by the Bears to stick with Justin Fields and to take the haul they could get. How are you thinking about the quarterback draft of 23, and how are you thinking about drafting quarterbacks in general as you observe it from your current position?
So I'll lead in by saying I was very fortunate to have, of course, Matt Ryan. He's a PA guy for you guys, mm-hmm. right? I mean, mm-hmm. What he did for us over those years, that was my very first pick to ever, you know, pick a player as a dog, the lead dog in the seat. Wasn't easy. Believe me, we had people around our city who wanted us to take a D tackle or a running back. I won't even tell you some of the people that were in my ear over those times. We knew we needed a quarterback. Of course, we made our move, and we were not looking back on it with Matt Ryan. By the way, Matt Ryan played 14 years for the Falcons, 1.5 games missed. Think about that. And believe me, I'm not proud to say this. He got his ass pummeled sometimes. I mean, he really did. I mean, and yet he was a tough hombre, man. I love the way he played. Really, really important. I won't get into evaluation elements of it because we just talked about it on our last episode with Eric, because there is so much there on the evaluation of quarterbacks. Suffice it to say, your quarterback is the way you go. We know that. I also believe 100% that as a general manager, you are truly evaluated by not only how you evaluate that quarterback coming into the league, how you sign them and how you maintain that quarterback over the years. I'm not just saying that because Matt was with us for 12 years. I am saying that you can be the best general manager out there. If you're not hitting on your quarterbacks, that's a tough road to travel, right? So these guys right now that are in their spots, let's if you don't mind, let's start with Ryan Poles. Going into his second year, he makes a big-time move here, right? Mm-hmm. He makes a big-time move because he believes – A, that he's going to stay with Justin Fields. I mean, to have a quarterback like that, that's a number one big move in of itself, right, gentlemen?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You're not only giving your fan base and the media out there the check mark that you're staying with the guy, but what it's done is done a great thing for the organization, the player himself, the quarterback himself, and the organization to believe and get behind Fields. That's a big thing in making that move, that they know that they can stay there. They also, you know, they trade the way they traded there very quickly. When you're talking about bringing in a receiver as they have, who now allows Fields along with who did they bring in last year? Oh man, it's on the tip of my tongue. Another receiver they had from last year. Anyway, so they're building that group. They'll also be able to look at a tight end when they've done what they've done. Traded back, acquired more ability to pick people up in the draft. To me, I've always said this: if you can make those moves and check the boxes, and then in the draft you're able to sit where you are, you have a quarterback to grow with, and you can take care of a couple moves in free agency, then you can focus on the draft. To me, that is a much more settling feeling than going into the draft with the precariousness of a draft, and you've not logged any of those acquisitions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying spend frivolously, but that was part of how we did things, you know, in those years. And without getting off on talking about Atlanta, you know, we did it with Michael Turner early on with Matt Ryan. We did it with Tony Gonzalez when we brought him in. And every year we did it with Alex Mack as a center from Cleveland. We built some pillar players through free agency. And then we tried, of course, to supplement with or build through the draft, obviously. So, and supplement with free agency. So quarterbacks, you guys want to pepper me with more questions. The quarterback class, you know, it's nice to be back there where there's a quarterback class, but I am telling you right now, and I love Scott Fitterer. Scott Fitterer now in his going into his fourth year, that's a tough situation to be in. You have to pick the right quarterback. I don't think Frank Reich has the pressure on him that Scott Fitterer has. Mm-hmm. And I think Scott is a really good football man, but he's got an owner right now in David Tepper who wants a quarterback desperately. Think about that, the pressure you're putting on that number one quarterback, whether that's Young or Stroud or someone else who everyone starts talking about, like because he had a great combine. I'm not being facetious here, that he should be considered the first overall pick.
Well, but that does raise an interesting question. I mean, I don't know about number one, but there's this general question of, are we better at developing quarterbacks than we used to be? For the longest time, the conventional wisdom became a guy's never going to throw for a higher completion percentage in the NFL than he did in college. You've seen his ceiling. And then, you know, we've seen that blown away by Josh Allen. And it raises the possibility that maybe we're now able to develop quarterbacks, which of course is very alluring to the coaches and the scouts who see someone like Anthony Richardson and think, yeah, he hasn't done all that much in the field so far, but look at that athlete and we can mold him. We're more confident now we can mold him. Is that legit or is that still just a fantasy?
No, I do believe that. I think there is a movement towards being able to develop quarterbacks. I think a big part of developing quarterbacks is making sure that you are very, very stout, not only with your head coach, and that relationship between your head coach and your quarterback is vital, but you move down the line. If your coordinator and your position coach, your quarterback coach, have to be so in tune with how you are going to develop this quarterback, and not only the physical side of working with him and helping that quarterback grow, but putting him in the right scheme and being creative with how you can make sure you're taking the pressure off of that quarterback while he develops. We, again, back to Michael Turner, we had a running back that was going to take the pressure off of Matt Ryan in year one, two, and three. And we believed that Matt Ryan, we really were trying to press him in those early years to be an incremental leader. In no way did we expect that leader to come in here, pound his chest, and rule the roost out the gate. Mm-hmm. You can't do it, I don't believe. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the old days you could. I think making sure that you bring the quarterbacks along, not only the mechanics of it all, but also the schematic element of it all. And I brought this up the other day, gentlemen, I don't know what you feel. If you had a quarterback that you saw had all the ability in the world, let's say Richardson, whoever it is, you knew that he was lacking in certain areas. And yet you also knew that you had to walk this new kid that you're going to have come into your building, or figuratively and literally around the building. You're going to have to, get him his own office. I don't want to start talking about Russell Wilson. That's not fair, because I like George Payton a lot. I mean, his own parking spot, you have his own massage therapist, his own dietitian, and you are just completely surrounding that quarterback with everything. Would you do that? Or would you be worried about the deleterious effects of putting all of that effort into that quarterback? Or would you not do it? Because there are some people out there that say they would do it with the receiver, but not the quarterback. And there's a lot of jealousies within buildings, right?
Right.
So, would you do it if you thought that was going to make him the best quarterback possible?
Yeah, and I think one kind of aspect of that is, I feel like I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. I think there's like an increasing trend to kind of have rookie QBs kind of be starting out of the gate, or like, I feel like historically we've allowed our QBs, even for teams that desperately need a new QB, to kind of develop under the leadership of a more senior QB, like not start in their first year. But now I feel like we're seeing more and more quarterbacks kind of being asked not only to kind of have that NFL skill set right out of the gate, but maybe to have that leadership skill set right out of the gate. Are we kind of doing our rookie quarterbacks a disservice right now by kind of hoisting those expectations and kind of like on them earlier than we used to?
Look, it's a great question. I maintain it is, we all know, not for long league. It's more not for long than ever. Think about it, not only because your owners, I mean, I had an owner and I loved Arthur Blank, but Arthur Blank was a 2-year man. I feel very fortunate that I was there that long, but man, it got edgy a year and a half in. It wasn't just the heat that I was feeling, outside the media. I mean, Arthur had high expectations. These GMs right now, it's unbelievable, by the way, and I hope this, maybe you guys have followed this. Those years, 10 plus years ago, GMs were coming into the league and they were making $1 million a year. Still awesome money for most people in the world beyond. I get that. Now, that many years later, which is almost, you know, let's see, 10, 12 years later, you're having first-time general managers ripping a $6 million a year contract out. Think about life-changing. Think about how important it is and the pressure that they have on themselves to win now. They can't fiddle around anymore. So where before you could sit in the hopper a little bit and hopefully get along with your owner, stay for a few more years, at $6 million a year, some of the new guys out there that are making that, they're not hanging. They're not hanging. So what I would say right now is get them in the saddle, teach them now, let the owner know that you made the right choice as a quarterback and that he's evolving. That's one of the things that's going to settle the owner a little bit and hopefully says, okay, I'm ready to parlay this into the next contract and the next contract.
So, Thomas, let me ask you, how much do you, when you were both the GM and also when you're doing your work at Sumer, how much do you think about what I'll call team-dependent or context-dependent drafting? What I mean by that is maybe you have Bryce Young rated the highest, but not for us. How much do you think about for our coach, our receivers, our system, this is the right quarterback, or it's just better is better? How do you think about that?
No, look, it's another good question. I am a big believer in sort of needs motivated, and I've got taken shots on it by the Atlanta people and the Atlanta media. Like, why aren't you just taking the best player out there? Whether it's best player in general or whether it's the best player at the position, because I am a huge believer in. You need to look at the whole picture, you know, with the players that you're bringing in. And there are times, and I learned this from Bill Belichick. I mean, Bill was great. Again, no matter where you are on the spectrum of believing in Bill and Bill's approach or reticence, whatever it may be that he has that might not settle with you. You know, Bill was great about looking at those one, two, and three different things with the players that we had there and making sure that they fit in with our system with the Patriots. And he really didn't care what anyone else said out there. And if he thought that this one player, Mike Vrabel, for instance, as a player, did three or four things better than anyone in the league, even though there was someone or five or seven guys out there that did 10 things better than him, if the organization only needed him to play and excel in those three or four spots, you're damn right that's where he is going. He is going to spend his time. He may not take him at the first pick, but he may say justifiably, we don't need to take an outside linebacker in the number one slot. We'll take him in the third round because he fits the system, the organization, and the coaching staff better.
Mm-hmm. It's a great example of considerations that analysts don't give enough weight to. And we can debate the merits of it, but there's so many other pressures in the building that the GM has to navigate. And that's just the practical reality of it. Thomas, invaluable to get some time with you. Thanks for making time for us this afternoon.
Well, I really enjoyed talking with you. I hope I didn't speak too much here, guys. Anytime. No, as we get closer to the draft, let me know if you need me.
We will probably take you up on that. Thank you. Thomas Dimitroff, CEO of Sumer Sports, former GM of the Atlanta Falcons, before that personnel man with the multi-champion New England Patriots, Thomas Dimitroff. That has been three quarters here on Wharton Moneyball. We still have a quarter to go. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. Rolling into the fourth quarter now. Coming up out of the bottom of the hour on the heels of Deion Simpkins' chosen transition music. Always a pleasure to be in the studio with Deion. We don't get that. We don't get those transitions when we're recording on Zoom. We miss it. We miss you, Deion. This is Cade Massey hosting with my longtime collaborators, faculty colleagues, good buddies Shane Jensen and Eric Bradlaugh. Audie is out today. Audie will be back. We are into the fourth quarter now, another open segment quarter on the far end of the show after a couple of interviews. We want to talk about March Madness. We have just come through the first two rounds. We have Sweet 16 in front of us in a couple of days. Before we do that, a little golf and a little tennis quickly, and in particular, mailbag. It's been a little while since we've had a mailbag on the show, and it's important that we do that. We get some interesting mail from you guys. We love hearing from you. Please keep them coming. Moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu. Moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu is our email address. Great way to catch us. We have a note. I think it's not the first time Ted has written, but Ted Fulton. Ted is faculty at the University of Delaware. And Ted's taking a little bit of issue with our golf analysis, and in particular, Eric's. And he got away with something we didn't bust him on, Shane. And Ted's making a really good point. If you remember, Scottie Scheffler won the TPC yesterday, and we got onto a pretty big Scottie Scheffler and hotness conversation at golf. And Ted's pointing out, you've got to account for the change in competition due to all the guys who've gone over to play LIV golf. And are we really properly adjusting? And we're giving all this adulation to the Rahms and Schefflers of the world who are going on these runs. Have we properly adjusted for the fact that they don't have to compete anymore against DeChambeau, Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, Cam Smith, et cetera, or at all?
Okay, so let me address it. So of those players, let me say the point is right. Only really two of them were in the top 20 in the world in the last 2 years. So Cam Smith was definitely in the top 10 in the world, and Dustin Johnson was. Brooks Koepka was coming back from injury. Brooks Koepka hadn't won a tournament in over 3 years. You mentioned DeChambeau. DeChambeau won the U.S. Open, I think, 3 years ago, but hasn't won a tournament since. So the only you're right. I mean, yes. But Scottie Scheffler, even if those players were there, is still competing against 18 of the top 20 players in the world and 45, I think, of the top 50. So you're right. It has weakened, but it's not weakened so much that I think the degree – let me just say, there's many effects – I'm the effect size guy on this show. I think the effect size of competition isn't as large as this question suggests, but the question is correct.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if you could even kind of – get at that effect size by doing some kind of simulation where you kind of what's Scheffler's expectation going into a tournament, you know, with or without those particular players among the contenders. I think my intuition, though not nearly as informed as yours, is the same, that I can't imagine, you know, because, you know, there's still, you know, that top 20 that Scheffler's actually facing are, you know, the absence of those players, I don't think moves the needle much in terms of actual kind of expected outcome.
If you had to kind of heuristically think about it, the top players might have a probability going into a tournament of what, 2-3%? The top players.
Yes, the top players.
So you're talking about scraping off 5, 6, 7%. And then,
but
so,
remember, I'm replacing them with other players that are still there that may have – it's the differential in percentage.
Yeah,
so it's just even –
but if you replace them with the 77th or the 121st or whatever –
I understand. It's not quite as high.
But all you have to do is you have to gross down their probability by that change in – you're moving – you know, you need to gross down from whatever it takes if you're spending 93% to the field.
Well, so here's a different way of thinking about it. Let's imagine from a purely statistical perspective, let's imagine we took the top 20 players for the moment. And let's just assume they all have the same distribution of strength. You're asking for, over four rounds, the distribution of the minimum of, let's say, 18 players versus 20 players. There's not going to be that much difference because you have a fairly large enough sample and you're still looking for the minimum of them. And, you know, you have enough people. So I'm not overly concerned that even
That's a nice way to think about it.
Mm-hmm. So even if it were an 18-player field versus 20, even if I was literally reducing two players, the distribution of the minimum score wouldn't change that much.
Fantastic. I want to point out that the simulation that Shane is suggesting is exactly where the golf better, the quants, mm-hmm. that's where they come up with that stuff. And so they'd have a precise answer to it. But Ted Fulton, thank you for that note. Eric, you had another thing on golf I think you wanted to do.
No. The only thing I was going to say about golf is that I'm starting to believe stronger and stronger, because in last week's tournament, again, Jordan Spieth was leading by a stroke with five holes left. He lost the tournament by two. And I'm going to start – we need to get Rufus Peabody on here, because I'm going to tell you – Jordan Spieth hasn't won a major. We talked 2 weeks ago about McIlroy hasn't won a major in 8 years. Spieth hasn't won one in 6 years. I'm starting to believe these what I'll call battle scars. It's not momentum. It's, in some sense, these players who can't finish the end of tournaments, it starts to get, I'm telling you, there's a serial dependence here. There's a, I'm not calling it momentum. There's a measurable serial dependence. And I guarantee you the sharps that are betting on golf are noting about how many tournaments these people lose when leading and et cetera. Because again, it was just so obvious. How could Jordan Spieth, and by the way, he's a top 10 player. The guy that won, I think, was ranked 77. He wasn't even competing against Scheffler or Rahm or any of these guys. And he lost the tournament. So this is happening over and over again.
Eric, I don't know the dynamics of what happened late in the round, but just being the skeptic of these kinds of stories, even though I understand sometimes it's true, I want to push on it a little bit. I mean, there's a difference between losing it in the Greg Norman at the Masters kind of way versus somebody reaches out there and takes it. And one of the crazy things about golf is that every now and then the 76th best player actually goes on a heater Sunday afternoon and flies past him.
Yeah, that wasn't it. That wasn't it. So Spieth was at least, I think he was at least tied, might have been up one when the other person was in the clubhouse. So if Spieth had parred out or certainly played the last five holes in one under, he would have won the tournament. He actually dropped three strokes in the last five holes and lost the tournament.
Well, you're right. This is a question for the quants because mostly I don't think they consider it. And the question's how they've investigated it and what edge they think might be there. What about on the tennis front? We talked about this tournament going in. It's a TPC 1000. Hold on. I got the number right, but not the letters. ATM?
ATP. ATP. ATP 1000.
ATP.
This was Indian Wells.
Yes, Indian Wells. Exactly. Even I know Indian Wells. And our boy Alcaraz is back on the scene. Even I saw this as well, right?
Yeah, he's not only back on the scene. He was coming back from injury. He won the tournament. He's back to number one in the world as a 19-year-old. Remember last year, he was the youngest ever number one in the world at age 18. He didn't lose a set in the tournament. And he Daniil Medvedev, who had won three straight tournaments, who was number one in the world, is now down to number five. He beat him 6-2, 6-3. And Medvedev had no chance. And so, you know, after the match, the only part that struck me was the long-term forecasting. So Jim Courier, another Grand Slam champion himself who does the commentating, said, if Alcaraz doesn't get injured, which is a big if because he's already been injured some, but if he doesn't get injured, he says he guarantees you he's going to win at least 10 majors in his career.
Ooh. Wow.
And by the way, I think if there's any chance that Djokovic doesn't end up with the most majors, it's because Alcaraz is as great as Jim Courier just said.
Wow.
Because, by the way, here's another. I was looking at this. Alcaraz clearly can win on hard courts. Matter of fact, he won his major at the U.S. Open on a hard court. Do you know when the last time Nadal beat Djokovic on a hard court? It was 2011. He hasn't beaten him on a hard court in 12 years. Now, he's beaten him many times on clay, but not on the hard court. So, obviously, in my view, even if Nadal comes back, which he's coming back, there's no evidence he can beat the top players anymore on the hard court. But I think Alcaraz can, and I think Medvedev can. I think those are the two players that if Djokovic doesn't end up with 30 majors, it's because the two of them just win a bunch of the hard court majors and they don't all go to Djokovic over the next couple of years. But I just thought that was an amazingly startling fork. He's basically saying this guy, at worst, is going to be Bjorn Borg, Pete Sampras, and Rod Laver. And I'm thinking, holy moly, that's at 19 with one major in the bank?
It's bold, but note that it's not disconnected from the conversation we just had about competition in golf. Last week, you were talking about how weak generations of tennis players have been. So as soon as the big three roll off, which is like 15 minutes from now, the field's going to be wide open, right?
Wide
so
open.
If there is a great player, he's just going to face so much less competition. So he might just have an easier path to the prediction that Courier's making.
That's a great point because if he's as great as he is, he might pick up 10 majors in the next 5 years. It may not even take
but
him 15 years.
I think that's the part we can actually like. We can talk
that's
about
right.
how he's
that's
in
right.
this.
Right.
You know, he's got this window of maybe the next 5 years where maybe he's going to be the only person. 5 years from now, like
there could be a 17-year-old
right.
who's 22.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. All right, let's talk a little March Madness. We're into the round of 16 now. It's been a fabulous tournament so far, with the second ever 16-over-1, which is one of our favorite statistical topics in sports, really, as well as some others. And Princeton not only knocks off Arizona in round one as a 15 seed, they go on to win their second round as two, and they're into the second weekend. And in fact, they only have a 6 seed Creighton in front of them. So lots of fun stories. Anything in particular catch your eye about this?
Well, I mean, I got to thinking sort of, you know, I mean, because we often sort of, I mean, I think even last week we talked about kind of this kind of talking about kind of the surprisingness of a tournament being summarized basically in kind of the sum of the remaining seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm curious to sort of see, given that Princeton's in there as a 15 seed still, does their placement in this Sweet 16 make this at the Sweet 16 level already an outlying observation in terms of the sums of the remaining seeds at the Sweet 16 level? And you guys are both kind of giving me like,
the last 3 years, I think a 15 seed has made the top of the Sweet 16.
So
I think St. Peter's made it.
They went further.
Yeah.
I think they went to the Elite Eight. And I forget, there was one other team 2 years ago, I think, that also made it a 15 seed. So, I mean, I'm saying.
I'm kind of interested in kind of just within the distribution of past tournaments, how surprising we are to this stage. But I'm also more interested in kind of, is being surprising to this stage predictive of surprise at the end? Like, does where you're at in the distribution of remaining seeds at the Sweet 16 level, does that at all predict whether or not you'll still be in kind of...
What's your intuition?
That's mine, too. Right. If you asked me right now to update my belief about the total sum of the seeds in the Final Four, I'm trying to decide if I would be over or under 10. 10 and a half, let's call it. So there's still two ones left. There's no reason they can't make it. There's a couple of three twos left. There's no reason it could be two ones and two twos.
But Eric, it can't be actually, because out of the East, the lowest seed you have is K-State is a three.
This is what makes it fascinating, because structurally there's some correlation.
So the minimum
built
is seven
in.
Now, right? The minimum is seven. There could be two ones, a two, and a three.
That's right. That's the minimum. That's the minimum.
Oh, then it's going to be over 10 and a half, I think. I think it's going to be over 10 and a half. I think, by the way, the other thing that struck me, this is maybe just a feel-good story, was when Princeton won, you know, even though, you know, at Penn we're supposed to hate Princeton, but I do root for the Ivy League because I never want them to take
Penn
the Ivy League.
Penn gave them a good run.
I watched that game. I was almost going to go to Princeton. I was almost going to go to Jadwin Gym to watch. It was the Ivy League semifinal.
Yeah, right.
Penn played Princeton and was tied 70-70 with a minute left in the game, by the way. But the feel-good story for me was the coach of Princeton was the starting point guard on, previous to this, the greatest victory ever in the history of Princeton basketball. You guys may not remember it. In 1996, Princeton defeated the defending national champion UCLA. It was Pete Carrill's greatest victory. Mm. Mitch Henderson, who's the coach of Princeton, was the starting point guard on that team.
Okay.
And then in the 98 team, when they also beat, I think it was, I don't know if it was a defending national, they beat UNLV, he was the starting point guard on
that
team. He's got two victories, two in the same tournament, and now he's the coach of the team. So I thought that was a feel-good story.
Yeah, you're right. Spectacular.
I think they can beat Creighton. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, it's the biggest line in the round of 16. So Creighton's a 10-point favorite, which is head and shoulders above the next. Both Houston and Alabama, the 2-1 seeds left, are 7-point favorites. But sure, I mean, anything can happen. Pretty obviously.
Do you think there's? You know, it's interesting. So this gets to updating, and I'll ask Massey of Massey Peabody about this. How much updating? Let's imagine Creighton had played Princeton a week and a half ago before the tournament. Would Creighton have been the same 10-point favorite? So this is basically, they've updated very little that Princeton has beaten a number 2 seed and a number, I think it was 8 or 9 seed. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been close to 10 2 weeks ago, and that's to, I don't know if it's the sharps, to the non-sharps, it seems like, are they nuts? Take Princeton and take the 10.
So I actually heard some sharps having this conversation. I think it was on Rufus's podcast with Jeff Ma, Bet the Process. Great podcast. Recommend it. They were talking to some bettors. I think it was talking to Ken Pomeroy. And they were talking about, do you upweight the tournament game? So obviously you're updating your models on teams as you go throughout the season. And then Rufus, who's like, this season, seriously modeling college basketball, is asking Ken Pom, so what do you do with the tournament games? Do you think they're different? Do you upweight them? And he said, well, the argument for upweighting would be that the one thing we're pretty sure about is that teams generally play with shorter benches. And so depth matters a little bit less, and the strength of the top of the roster.
And also non-stationarity and recency would say to put more
yeah,
weight.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're talking about kind of you disproportionately upweight beyond what the recency – like you wouldn't – you don't treat these tournament games like they're just a couple more games at the end of the regular season.
No, I wasn't doing that. I'm just saying – you're saying standard models update for recency anyway.
That's
they
right.
wouldn't
yeah,
– okay,
to the extent,
that's different.
Yeah,
okay.
That's exactly.
Right. And we're saying, is there anything on top of that? We're basically asking, is there anything special about the tournament? And Palm said, I think the thing to consider is the shorter bench, essentially, which is interesting. I don't know which way that pushes for some of these guys, but interesting. I want to ask you a different question about because we talked a lot about transfers, the transfer portal in football, and then we really haven't talked about it much in basketball. And it feels like it can be more substantive in basketball because a single player can make a bigger difference. We just had the conversation about short benches. And so here's a question for you. What do you think the distribution of number of players from the portal that our final 16 teams have? And let's limit it to their rotation. And so call the rotation, you know, guys that have double digit minutes or something. So some teams.
So what percentage?
Just like the number of players. So
number of players.
A rotation might average, you know, 8-9 players. It's going to vary. Some guys, Alabama goes 10 deep. You know, Xavier's probably more like 6 deep.
So but do you want us to assume there's like 150 players that play 16 times 9 or 10, which is 150?
Whatever you want to do, sure.
How many of those did the college draft versus give
you
a transfer?
20%, 30. I'm just total guess.
I wouldn't put it any higher than that, I don't think.
So in a rotation of 10, you might have two players or a little bit less than two players
for an eight or nine.
Okay, and what do you think it was just a couple years ago? I mean, for perspective, it would have been...
Did the rules change that they have to sit? Players had to sit if they transferred before and now? Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. 0.2.
Yeah, exactly. It's 3.25. The average is 3.25 for these 16 teams, which is, it tells you something about the impact of this rule. And I think it's the reason why you might see talent, you might see a little bit more competitive distributed outcomes. I mean, we always see pretty distributed in the tournament, but... You know, this would argue.
How wonderful is this?
I think it's great. Exactly. I agree entirely.
And also, if you turn out, you know, the other thing is you get to go to another school where not just you get more minutes, but, you know, you can utilize your skills more. I think this is a great thing for college basketball.
By the way, the lowest seed in that East region, we're talking about K-State, the 3 seed, all 9 of the guys in their rotation, all 9 rotational players. The lows, UCLA is 0, Princeton is 0. But 3.25 across the 16. It'll be a fun weekend. All right, guys. It has been 4 quarters of Wharton Moneyball for the whole crew here. Adi in absentia. Eric, Shane. This has been Cade. Deion Simpkins, many thanks to you. Maddie Datz, thanks to you. Appreciate you guys listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.